All righty, Kim Gordon. Thanks very much. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a Monday edition. I want to say thanks very much to Elise Glink, Suzanne Mushin, I think John Hansen as well, everyone who filled in for me last week. I took a group of WGN listeners on an outstanding tour of Iceland. There's so much to talk about there. You know, the Inno boys are in the studio, Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke, and obviously, we looked at waterfalls, we looked at mountains, and we ate puffin and things like that.
Oh, no.
I did. I had a little puffin, a little smoked puffin.
Did you pass the puffin?
I did not pass on the left-hand side.
Puffin pass.
No. Different puffin. But one of the things we did a little innovation, too, or talked about energy and the way I think it's almost 80% of the homes in Iceland. Now, there aren't many, but are fueled by hot water, whether it's generating electricity
awesome.
Or heated. It's all, you know, they're on the near these volcanoes. They pump up the super hot water from the earth. They heat groundwater with it and pump it to people. There are pipelines carrying hot water all over that country. And I learned quite a lot about that. It was pretty
70%
fascinating.
70% of the houses?
Yes, it was between 70 and 80% of the homes. Not just heat, but also electricity generated all by hot water. So they have, it's traveling to Europe or Iceland or wherever. And this comes on the heels of the president withdrawing from the climate agreement.
Yeah.
It's just stark, the different attitude in other countries when it comes to conservation and addressing these things. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's also a reminder when it comes to federal or any government innovation, size matters. It's so much easier to implement innovation broadly when you are smaller. A state here in the country that does really innovative things from a federal level is Rhode Island. Why? Because it's easier to innovate in Rhode Island than it is any other state. Just, yes, I'm amazed by what you just told me about Iceland, but Iceland is what, the size of Maryland?
It's the size of Kentucky.
Yeah.
And about 330,000 people. But that's an excellent point. When you have as many interests, but they aren't as big.
Yes.
And you have fewer people to win over, maybe. But you're right. They are smaller, and they do benefit from that.
I want to know when you're going to take us on one of these trips.
Want you guys to do it. I want a
Iceland
Chicago Inno trip. So figure it out. We'll set it up.
Yeah.
All right. So we didn't really come in to talk about that. Orion mentioned Uber, and we talk a lot about Uber. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems like this is one of the groundbreaking companies, and then they deal with crisis, and it's been crisis after crisis for Uber. Another shoe drop today.
Exactly. And Uber is sort of this example of, you know, how many scandals can a company take without some actual penalties and some repercussions to their actions. So, yeah, they just lost one of their SVP of business today, who resigned from the company following an investigation from Eric Holder, basically off of sexual harassment allegations and just sort of corrupt company behavior sort of business-wide.
And this was among corporate employees, not drivers to passengers.
Right. We're talking about the corporate company Uber here. And
the CEO might be on his way out or at least go away for a while.
There is talk that he could be on a leave of absence. It seems like that's likely to happen. He had a very tragic accident with his family. His mother passed away in a boating accident. So it just seems like this might be the perfect time for him to definitely step back and let some other leadership come in and take over.
Yeah, there was a 7-hour board meeting yesterday on Sunday where there was all these recommendations like, here's the people we think need to be fired or need to move on. We think the CEO needs to leave of absence. And what's being reported is that the board agreed to every recommendation. So you're going to see a significant shakeup. One thing I would like pause people on the reaction train is you're seeing a lot of like, what does this mean for Silicon Valley broadly? Forever, these founders have worked on kind of like a let's get radical, a sense of kind of autonomy from this business rules
sure,
landscape.
Right.
And now that Uber, the most valuable private company in the country, is kind of being forced to play by these rules, does this mean that Silicon Valley is going to have to get, quote unquote, less radical? And I would say, like, let's pump the brakes on saying that this could be the start of a broader trend, because Uber is so far ahead when it comes to making mistakes than everyone else that you can't say, like, oh, this is, you know, they might apply this to every other company, because Uber has not just messed up once, not twice, but like we are now on number 20 or 50 of their scandals. So what's being applied to them, I think, is an outlier, because their bad behavior is an outlier.
But I do think, though, that this is a message to Silicon Valley that you can't just get away with anything. Like, you are going to have to clean up your ship. I mean, Uber has been bleeding top executives. They've already lost over, I think, 10 top executives too, right? So I think what you want to say here is that, like, listen, you can't get away with anything.
All right, that's Jim Dahlke, Will Flanagan in here as well, the boys from Chicago. You know, we're going to take a break because we got kind of far afield. I want to talk to you about the story about algorithms and predictive policing as well. It's 12:21. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. We have righted the ship. Steve Bertrand back here for, I hope, his extended stay after vacation last week, talking to the boys from Chicago, Inno. All right, so, Jim, you wrote the story about, we hear the police department talk about predictive policing, right? They look at data, they figure out where the next crime is going to be or who the next criminal might be, and that helps them crack down on crime. Well, a group of journalists is suing to get some answers as to how do they quite figure out who the target.
Exactly. A couple years ago, the police department got a $2 million grant to sort of initiate this predictive policing algorithm. Basically, what it sort of does is give the police department a list of people on a heat list. And basically what this list is a group of names of people who are likely to commit a crime based on their location to known criminals, their criminal history themselves, their location, and some other factors. The algorithm is a little bit of a mystery, and that's kind of what this lawsuit is going for.
We're all about data, right? In data and algorithms can figure out so many things, what I want for lunch tomorrow. Why couldn't it figure out who might be a criminal, and what's the danger there?
Exactly. So you look at, you know, predictive policing, and you say, you know, do you want to use technology to help predict a crime? And you sort of think, absolutely. But then when you really get down to what this does, I mean, there's a lot of racial profiling that's involved in this. The damage is that it's a potentially racist plan.
Well, by nature, it's profiling.
Exactly.
I mean, it absolutely has to be profiling.
And exactly. And it's a lot about how you implement the plan as well. I mean, does the algorithm basically just send police to people's doors and knock and intimidate folks before they've actually even done anything wrong?
And, you know, I was reading this, and I hadn't thought of it until you wrote this story in such a perceptive way. But I would say it was like that Tom Cruise movie.
Yeah, Minority Report.
Minority Report, right, where they knew in advance what the crimes were going to be.
Yeah, and I think it's important to know about this lawsuit is that it's not blindly against the algorithm. It's basically like, hey, if you're using an algorithm, we need a lot more information about what's going into it. Because, and Jim and I, we talked about this on the walk over. Yes, like, you would hope that you know, your local and federal government is using available data to do its job better. But you can't have a lousy algorithm, right? Like, if you're using an algorithm to predict crimes, it has to be
if you're going to target, it has to have some sort of
empathy built into it as well. It you need a set of eyeballs on it to make sure. So having this algorithm that hasn't even been sourced by a third party or at least viewed, that's what people need to take a look at.
Okay, back up. You used the term empathy. Explain to me, what do you mean it has to have empathy built in?
So I think, you know, and you see this a lot with AI and chatbots is, you know, algorithms, and especially when you get into artificial intelligence, you know, artificial intelligence and machine learning isn't just like, if person says X, I say Y, and then if person says Z, I say A, and now we go back. You have to program or figure out how to work a base level empathy into your algorithm so that it's not just making machine robot decisions. I am Steve's robot. I will push Steve out of the way, even if pushing you out of the way jeopardizes the lives of, you know, 100 or 100,000 whatever weird scenario that is. But making sure that these algorithms have kind of stop gaps for that. So if your algorithm does end up with this conclusion, what is the 2 to 5 filters that it needs to then go through to be like, all right, let me then weigh this suggested decision against human empathy.
And this is a Freedom of Information Act suit, so they're basically just requesting all the public information that they can get on this that they haven't been able to get yet. I mean, we certainly have reason to be skeptical of the Chicago Police Department, right? So it's like we should be able to see all the information and know more about how they're using this algorithm.
And they're the good guys. Yeah. They're still the good guys.
Totally.
But we want to see what's going on with it, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, 100%. And I think some of the headlines that you read about this made it feel like algorithm bad. And again, like, I think you want your police department to use available technology to do its job better, more efficiently. So this is a good thing. We're just I think it's important for people to really see inside the hood of the car here.
I got a buddy of mine who swears the best ice cream in the world is at a shop in Columbus, Ohio.
Yes.
If I could just get there,
Jenny's,
maybe.
Jenny's, right? Is it Jenny's?
It might be Grater's, which is back. Oh. They're up here now. But if I could just get there in 20, 30 minutes, I think my world would be a better world.
And that's exactly what the Hyperloop plans to do, Steve. So this is actually being led by a group in Ohio, the Mid-Ohio Regional Planning Commission. They are sort of spearheading the effort to do the Hyperloop through the Midwest, going from Chicago to Columbus to Pittsburgh, and all in about 45 minutes. This is part of Elon Musk's grand plan to put this high-speed tubular transportation system.
We talked about
system.
This before, so what's new now?
So what's new now is that we really dove into a conversation with the people who are launching this, and it's not from Chicago, it's not from Pittsburgh. It's Columbus, and what's going to happen is this group in Columbus really sees the Hyperloop as a way to revitalize the business community in Columbus and really think about, you know, you can live in Ohio and commute to Chicago to work and vice versa.
Well, there was a futurist interviewed not too long ago in Blue Sky, and my wife Sharon and I have been talking about this, about how you could be living soon in Peoria,
yeah,
and be a downtown Chicago worker.
100%.
And living is one thing, but it's also about transporting medicine. It's about getting food, you know, from food deserts. And it's a lot about changing the way we even think about where we set up, where we live, where we work, and everything we do basically in our life when we can transport somewhere in just minutes instead of hours.
Yeah, and Hyperloop is one of those words now that you start saying without even going into, wait, what is the Hyperloop again? Because wait, Chicago to Pittsburgh in 30 minutes. So the Hyperloop is, think about it as like pods that you would get in with one or two other drivers, and they go upwards to 750 to 800 miles per hour by basically levitating above a magnetic track. So, all right, this sounds really cool, right? We're going to get to Pittsburgh in 30 minutes. Steve, are you going to sign up for that?
Not Pittsburgh. No.
No, right? Like, that's the thing. This sounds so exciting. Yes, I can't, Jim and I, again, we were talking about this on the way over. We use the term mind-blowing probably way too much when talking about technology. The Hyperloop is mind-blowing.
Right.
To be able to get to Columbus that quickly changes so much stuff. There's actually a ton of venture capital firms in Columbus, and I'm wondering how that's going to like impact Chicago tech companies if they can now see pitch competitions overnight. That's amazing. But again, are you going to get in a pod that goes 750
miles? When I was a kid, I lived about 50 feet from the rail line. The city of New Orleans would go north and south, and I would put pennies on the rail lines, right? Could you put like a penny under the magnet? Is that going to foul things up? Wouldn't derail the train?
Regulations.
Those are certainly questions.
The regulations on this thing are going to be outrageous. Yeah. But you got to imagine, right? Like, these are probably the same conversations people were having with airplanes. You want to go up in an airplane 32,000 feet above this, you know, like it's the same kind of conversation, but I guess anything's more.
Totally. And my answer then would have been no, too.
Yeah. You're an innovator. You're a leader. Will Flanagan, the general manager of Chicago Inno, Jim Dahlke, a writer for Chicago Inno as well. Read a lot more. In fact, your homework really is to go and read the story about blockchain, Chicago Blockchain Center. And then once you do that, send me an email and explain it to me.
Send us an email. We wrote it.
Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a hot Monday afternoon, a summer afternoon in Chicago in the Allstate Showcase Studio right along Michigan Avenue. All right. I don't know if you have watched the show The Prophet on CNBC, Marcus Lemonis. It's hard to avoid Marcus. He's got a real footprint in this area, at billboards everywhere for the program as well. And tomorrow night's show features the Chicago shop, Windward Board Shop. The owner, one of the principals behind that is Chris Currier. Now, I'd never seen The Prophet before, but in preparation for talking to Chris this afternoon, I got a copy of tomorrow's show, watched it, and enjoyed it very much. I think I'm going to watch some more. Chris is on the phone line. Chris, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You bet. Now, I'm assuming you've seen tomorrow night's program, right?
I have not actually seen the episode.
Oh, good. I got a little power over you then.
I get to watch it live tomorrow.
No kidding. Well, I wouldn't have worn those clothes that you wore. They really made fun of them in the program.
I can't wait to see it.
Look, you're a brave guy, I think, because, maybe it's bravery out of necessity. But tell me a little bit about your store and how it is that you got Lemonis involved.
Sure. The store has been around in the same location in Chicago on Clark Street since 1982. And myself and two friends that you'll see on the episode tomorrow purchased the store about 6 years ago. And then probably about 9 months ago is when we got Marcus involved and working with him through the show.
So he got involved because you guys expanded maybe a little too quickly or maybe inadvisably expanded to a nice, big, bright, shiny store in Highland Park, not too far from where I live.
A little bit of both there. The business grew excessively quick over 6 years for us, and then we did expand pretty quickly and ran into some issues, and that's when we reached out through the Profit Casting online on CNBC.
So you just sent him a note online, and they picked you up?
Yeah, and it's funny. He lives up that way in Lake Forest and had actually been in the business prior to us even applying to the show.
Oh, no kidding. So he knew what you guys were talking about then.
Yeah, he knew a little bit of what he was getting into. He is a local guy there and had stopped in the store a few times.
So the idea was the business, which had been doing very well, expanded, ran into some trouble, and then, you know, was in trouble financially. Lamonis, as part of the show, comes in, makes an investment, and then you guys are sort of obligated to follow his direction and to turn things around. Things have turned around?
Yeah, you know, as you see in the episode, he is 100% in charge when he makes the investment in the business. But we looked at it as a great opportunity to have one of today's most incredible business leaders mentor and guide us and help get this business back on track.
It was a personal story for you. If you haven't seen the show, I don't want to give it away for you or anyone else, but it talks about your... you know, you inherited this money from your dad, you invested it after your dad passed away. And the idea was, you know, in a way you're kind of holding on to your dad with this shop. It's personal to see that it might go away. All of this took a little courage on your part. Did you ever regret doing it?
You know, it's been a great experience. I was very nervous going into it. I'm not a big camera guy, had never done anything like this in the past. But kind of once you get going, the cameras fade away. You focus on what you're doing in the business, and Marcus just, he gets going and you're sucked into it. And you really focus on the business end of it and don't worry as much about the cameras and what's happening with that. But it was a big step for me to put that out there publicly.
Yeah, I would imagine it really did, Chris. It was an emotional part of the program. I loved this show and I've never seen one before.
I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, I hope you do too.
Yeah.
What's Lamonis's involvement in the business now?
Oh, he's still involved. We talk on a weekly basis and he checks in. He kind of got us on track and we take it and run.
And so you closed the Highland Park store and you're focused now just on Clark Street?
We're focused on Clark Street, expanding our online business, and then a big thing that's not in the episode but happened recently after is we're partnering with Burton Snowboards to open a partner store in Chicago with Burton.
So you are going to expand, but with a little assistance as well?
With a little assistance and some good guidance from Marcus.
Now, what's the biggest thing you've learned through all of this?
Just being flexible and going with the flow. You know, you always have your mindset on where things are going to end up, and a lot, you have your game plan, but you got to be ready to adjust.
Were you guys?
Things are going to change.
Were you and your friends when you opened up this business? Did you do it with your mind or with your heart?
Both.
You
did. We all grew up snowboarding and skateboarding. We love the sport. We live it every day. And we were just so excited for this opportunity. We had grown up shopping at this location as kids.
It just struck me as the sort of thing. Well, that kind of makes sense. That's my impression, that this was something that involved your emotion a lot as well as your brain. So, well, look, I did enjoy the show. I'll be over tomorrow for the big viewing party.
Sounds good.
I wish you continued success. Congratulations. Thanks for joining us today, Chris.
Thanks. Thanks a lot for having me.
You bet. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. That's Chris Currier. The name of the shop when they started the program was Windward Board Shop. Thank you very much, Orion and Kim and Jim Ryan as well. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch. All right. Frank Lloyd Wright was born 150 years ago this summer. So we are marking that with events around the city, around the country, really. Chicago Curbed has been looking at it. A.J. LaTrace is the editor at Chicago Curbed, and he joins us on a phone line now. A.J., welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you being here. All right, let's start with a little perspective. I mean, how important is Frank Lloyd Wright and the real estate that he created in today's market?
Well, you know, the legacy of Frank Lloyd Wright can't be overstated. He's one of a handful of American architects who are considered to be sort of the pioneers of what eventually turned into modernism, modern architecture. But he designed hundreds of buildings throughout the country, but no other area has a larger collection than the Chicago area of his designs. And for example, just in Oak Park alone, there's 25 structures designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, including his own home and studio. But yeah, you know, there's usually at least one or two Frank Lloyd Wright designed houses on the market at any given point in the Chicago area. Right now, there's about a half a dozen. And so, yeah, if there's anyone out there looking to get into a Frank Lloyd Wright house,
this is your chance.
Now's a good time to start shopping.
So. Well, you know, so I know he worked with Sullivan and Adler, and maybe we can talk about that in a bit. But, you know, when I think of those guys, I don't think of individual homes. I'm not a big architectural guy, but I don't know of other architects who are known for designing and creating individual houses who stand up the way that that Frank Lloyd Wright does today. Am I wrong in that?
No, you know, in fact, so, you know, folks listening who may not be exactly familiar with Adler and Sullivan, that was a firm that Frank Lloyd Wright really cut his teeth with as a draftsman. And Sullivan and Adler designed a lot of commercial buildings, you know, like theaters was a big one. But, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright did design private residences. You know, many of his homes today are still privately owned houses. There are a couple of famous house museums. But, yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, over the decades, Frank Lloyd Wright really honed his craft, which, you know, some listeners out there may have heard of the term Prairie School.
And, right, sure.
One of the main architects of that era. But, you know, eventually, you know, he did develop as an architect, and he worked out and, you know, designed a lot of homes in L.A. And then, you know, ultimately, probably his famous work is the Falling Water House in rural Pennsylvania.
He referred to Louis Sullivan as his beloved master. I know you wrote that in the piece. But he got chased from that outfit, didn't he?
He did. You know, it's actually a really interesting story. You know, even today, for example, you know, When we sign contracts for employment, you know, a lot of times there's language with non-compete clauses in it. And, you know, this was the same situation 100 years ago, or, you know, back when Frank Lloyd Wright was working with Sullivan in the 1880s. And so, you know, being, you know, looking to kind of break out on his own and maybe make a little bit more money, Frank Lloyd Wright did take a few commissions under the table in Oak Park.
Right, and, it's the Chicago way.
Right. And so famously, one of the houses was actually on Louis Sullivan's block. And of course, he's going to ask about this and find out. So eventually he finds out that it's his own draftsman. And, you know, for better or worse, or ultimately, you know, for the better for architecture, the role of architecture, Wright was let go.
That's
from
kind
the firm.
Of it's kind of funny because the way you tell that story, he almost couldn't help himself. He had to know he was going to get caught.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a pretty Wright was not the most modest person, you know. he called it honest arrogance. So, yeah, taking a commission on Sullivan's block, his boss's block, was a pretty, you know, you could say perhaps an arrogant move on his part.
Well, that arrogance was described in a novel by Nancy Horan a few years ago. I remember talking to her. I can't think of the name of it now, but it was sort of a novelized version of Frank Lloyd Wright and relationships he'd had. Okay, so you said there are about a half a dozen homes on the market now. Why is it that there's, I'll call it a glut, but why is it that there's so many homes? Is it just coincidence?
You know, it might be. And a lot of these homes either relisted or reentered the market just in the last few weeks. I believe a couple of months ago, there was only like one or two houses on the market. But, you know, my suspicion would be that these owners, you know, they know Frank Lloyd Wright's story, and perhaps in anticipation of his 150th birthday, that may have been a good time to go ahead and relist.
If you are listing one of these houses, you better be prepared for the fact that it's going to take a long time, right? In some cases, years. Some cases, after being years on the market, they're pulled off the market. The houses don't sell very quickly.
Yeah, it really varies and really depends. But generally, generally we can say that, you know, a lot of these homes will spend a considerable amount of time on the market. Some not so much, but yeah, it's tough. I mean, a lot of these houses are, you know, works of art, you know, so it's almost like living in a work of art. And, you know, these are homes that are going to last or hopefully be around for generations. Right. And so it's not necessarily your home. You're sort of, you know, the caretaker of it for now until, you know, the next generation.
That's interesting. And works of art are also very subjective and might not be appealing to a lot of people. They're not always that comfortable inside, are they? Or, I mean, that's my impression with the Frank Lloyd Wright home.
Yeah, the interior layouts are very unique. You know, Wright's sort of thing was the path of discovery. And so a lot of his homes have very intentional sort of flows to them. And a lot of narrow hallways, a lot of times very low hanging ceilings. Part of this, the Prairie School ethos was sort of this like back to nature type of design. So, you know, the homes themselves almost, you know, they're very earthy, but, you know, for modern families, you know, obviously, open floor plans are really
right.
Having a moment right now. Well, these are kind of the opposite of that.
I'll tell you this, AJ, we move real estate on the Wintrust Business Lunch. So probably a couple have contracts later this week.
Yeah, let's hope so.
AJ Latrace, the editor for Curb Chicago. Hey, it was great to talk to you. I hope we can do it again.
Thank you.